From WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Are we there yet? Kids, be quiet. There's only 2 million more miles to go. NASA's newest rover is bearing down on Mars. 10 more days, and the Mars Science Lab will be roaring through the thin Martian air to make the craziest, most daring, and complicated landing you've ever seen. A video recreation of the landing is called 7 Minutes of Terror, and it's gone viral. This hour on Point, 7 Minutes of Terror and the Mission to Mars. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the 7 Minutes of Terror video yet? Will you stay up watching NASA TV on August 5th to see if this rover and the $2.5 billion it's costing us crashes and burns? You can comment at our website at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have the 7 Minutes of Terror video up on our website, along with videos of similar rover climbing sand dunes in the Mojave Desert and lots more. Take a look. It's cool. It's at onpointradio.org. We're going to be speaking to two NASA scientists this hour who are directly involved with this mission. First, joining me here in the studio is Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine. Kelly, hello.
Hey, Wade, how are you?
I'm great. So 2 million miles out, are we almost there?
We are almost there, and the countdown clock is going. We're expecting a landing on the night of August 5th out on the West Coast. It'll be early in the morning on August 6th here. If people want to stay up late, I wish them well, because it'll be a great show.
Well, if 2 million miles is almost there, how fast is this thing going?
You know, it's approaching Mars at about 3 miles a second. Mars and the spacecraft are both moving through space, so it's all relative. But when it actually reaches Mars, it's going to be hitting the atmosphere at 13,000 miles per hour. That's about 4 miles a second. And it has to go from there to zero in this 7 minutes. And so that's why they call it the 7 minutes of terror.
How long ago did it leave Earth?
You know, it left Earth last November 26th. It was launched from a rocket in Florida. And so it's traveled about 300 million miles to date to get there.
I don't remember it taking off. Did the public pay any attention? I seemingly did not.
You know, it did take off, and it was followed by a lot of people who have interest in this stuff. I think that these days we've kind of grown a little complacent with the space program. And so if it didn't make the nightly news, well, there you go.
How's it doing?
It's doing very well. They've been doing some checks on it the last couple of days, making sure that the radar, which will be critical for the landing, is working, that the batteries are charged. There was some good news recently. When this thing lands, and we'll get into this more later, it doesn't send its signal directly to Earth, but uses another spacecraft in orbit around Mars to relay that. The spacecraft itself, called Mars Odyssey, has been having some problems. Those have been corrected. They've kind of moved it a little bit, so it'll be in better position. I think it's green light all across the board.
Any anxiety?
Well, I always have anxiety. You know, NASA's not had 100% success rate with its Mars missions. Overall, in the whole history of spacecraft, more than half of all the spacecraft launched toward Mars have failed for one reason or another. The U.S. has done a little bit better, but we're still only batting 14 for 20, so it's not an assured thing. And a couple of high-profile missions, expensive missions, have failed just within the last 10 years or so. So, you know, it's never a sure thing. There are always things that can go wrong. And importantly, these spacecraft have to land on their own. They're not joysticked down to the surface, because Mars is so far away that there's no way to control the descent in real time.
Well, some of the mistakes that have happened were, you know, slap your forehead with your palm. Talk to me a little bit about what's gone wrong in the past and what you've learned from those errors.
You know, there was one very celebrated case a few years ago where a NASA spacecraft called Mars Climate Orbiter, there was an error in how the units were calculated for the rocket. One group was using pounds and the other group was using newtons, and there was a conversion factor. It's a metric English thing, very stupid, and the spacecraft basically just skipped by the planet. There was a real heartbreaker back in the late 1990s, a spacecraft that was supposed to land on the surface and study the polar regions where there's a lot of water and a lot of really interesting stuff. It went all the way in, just like this spacecraft is. and there was a glitch in how it landed, how it detected that the surface was coming up, and we just never heard from it. At that time, I was with all the young scientists who had invested, you know, much of their careers in this spacecraft, and the dejected, depressed looks on their face, it's going to stay with me my whole life.
It's devastating.
It really is. It really is. You put your entire careers in some cases, on the line for missions like this, and then to have it just go poof, wow, that's rough.
Here's a moment from NASA's video, 7 Minutes of Terror. The voice you hear is Tom Revellini, who has been working with our guest Anita Sengupta on the entry, descent, and landing operation, the so-called 7 Minutes of Terror.
We've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
It's game over.
It's game over. And, you know, as you pointed out at the top of the hour, this whole mission is costing about $2.5 billion. And you might ask, well, why is it costing so much? You know, we've been exploring Mars for a long time. Ever since the 1960s. And the first missions were easy. They just went by and took pictures. The next missions are harder. You go into orbit, and that takes more complexity. And now we've landed on the surface. And every time you ratchet it up like that, the complexity grows, the size of the spacecraft grows, the number of things that can go wrong and that you have to plan countermeasures for grows. So it's a lot invested. It's all on one spacecraft. Back in the old days, you know, they used to launch two identical spacecraft so that in case one failed, you had a backup. No more. It's one and done. And so there is an awful lot riding on it.
I'd like to bring in somebody who knows personally just how hair-raising this landing will be. From Pasadena, California, we're joined by Anita Sengupta. She's the senior systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and she's one of the engineers responsible for the entry, descent, and landing part of the mission. This is the famous 7 Minutes of Terror. Welcome, Anita, to the show.
Hi, Wade. Nice to talk to you.
So how is your morale 10 days out?
It's really good. I'm incredibly excited. This is going to be the highlight of my career to date, for sure. So I'm really looking forward to a successful landing next Sunday night.
Tell us how the 7 minutes is going to work. Let's go step by step.
Okay, and feel free to break in as I describe the different aspects of the descent in case you want to ask more questions. But basically, just to start off with, this is our most challenging EDL mission to date. So EDL stands for Entry, Descent, and Landing. And the reason for that is because we're flying the biggest rover to date. So our rover is about 950 kilograms. So it's basically the size of a small car. And obviously, it has the mass and the weight of a small car. And so we have to be able to take that large mass and get it from exoatmospheric, about 125 kilometers, 13,000 miles an hour, all the way down to the surface, down to 0 miles an hour. So what that is you have a lot of energy and you have to dissipate that energy. And we have different ways of dissipating that energy. So we're coming in at this incredibly fast speed. And because Mars has an atmosphere, that atmosphere actually creates aerodynamic drag around the vehicle. So we have our rover, which is encapsulated in something called an entry vehicle. And that entry vehicle basically kind of looks like on one side of it, looks like a very blunt object, like a blunt bowl. And you know, when you put your hand out the window when you're driving down the highway, you feel the wind kind of buffing against your hand. That's called aerodynamic drag. So we actually have our vehicle experiencing that aerodynamic drag. And what that does is it actually helps to slow it down, but it also tends to heat it up. So as we're coming in, we actually experience very high deceleration forces on the order of 12 Gs. That's 12 times the gravity on Earth. And we experience very high heating rates. And it actually gets the front of our entry vehicle to reach temperatures close to the surface temperature of the sun, about 2,000 degrees. And so in order to mitigate those temperatures, we use a technology called a heat shield. And that heat shield has a special material on it. It's called a thermal protection system material. And that material essentially absorbs that energy and burns away and ablates away. So it helps to slow our vehicle down, and we're protecting the rover inside of our entry vehicle because we're mitigating this heat with this very large heat shield. So whilst we're descending in this way, this is actually descending at hypersonic speeds. This is well, well above the speed of sound on Mars. We're actually also flying the vehicle. Our vehicle is kind of like, doesn't look like an airplane, but it actually acts like an airplane because it has a slight angle of attack. And that actually allows us to do roll, pitch, and yaw on the vehicle like you would with an airplane. So we're flying it down. getting it closer to where we want our final landing point to be. We're decelerating because of this aerodynamic drag on our heat shield.
Well, let me, when you say that you're flying it down, are you actually flying it down, or is it flying itself down?
Yes, it's flying itself. So it has a very smart guidance and control system on board. So it has an understanding of where it is and where it needs to go. And it is flying itself by firing a series of little rocket engines on the back of it. They're called reaction control system thrusters. And so it's flying itself down. So we basically are watching it, and we're going to get telemetry back, you know, obviously after the time delay. But we're basically decelerating and flying this way, and then we come down from about 13,000 miles an hour down to 1,000 miles an hour just on our heat shield. And at that point, we are about 1,000 miles an hour, which is roughly Mach 2, two times the speed of sound on Mars, and we deploy a very large parachute. It's a supersonic parachute. It's actually the largest supersonic parachute we've ever built at NASA. It is 21.5 meters in diameter, which, if you think about it, it's about 60 feet in diameter. So you can probably fit around two school buses inside of there. That's how big it is. And the reason why it needs to be that big is because we have a very thin atmosphere on Mars. We need to create more drag. So would you like me to continue after the break?
Yes, please. We're talking about NASA's newest mission to Mars, the hair-raising 7 minutes of terror that will happen when the spaceship hits the edge of the Martian atmosphere in 10 days. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about the landing any day now of NASA's newest rover on the surface of Mars and the wild, complicated rise the car-sized rover will have to make as it rockets down to the surface of the planet. My guests are Kelly Beattie, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine, Anita Sengupta, Senior Systems Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Remember, we've got the 7 minutes of terror video and much more on our website, onpointradio.org. Here's another excerpt from the moment from the NASA's video 7 minutes of terror describing the rocket phase of the landing on the computer.
Once we turn those rocket motors on, if we don't do something, we're just going to smack right back into the parachute. So the first thing we do is make this really radical diverting maneuver. We fly off to the side.
Diverting away from the parachute, killing our horizontal velocity and our vertical velocity, getting the rover moving straight up and down so it can look at the surface with its radar and see where we're going to land. And we head straight down to the bottom of a crater.
Anita, that's actually where you and I left off. When the parachute deploys and there's the heat shield separation and the radar data, there's the radar data collection. This moment where the rover has to kind of maneuver away from the parachute, in the video, it seems problematic.
Well, it is a tricky maneuver, but we have a lot of we've done a lot of testing on our system. We've done a lot of analysis on our systems. We have a good understanding of how the engines are going to perform. We have a good understanding of the aerodynamics of the situation in terms of how the parachute's moving, how the heat shield's moving, and how the rover will be moving. So we've got a very good handle on what that situation actually looks like. And that's essentially the start of our powered descent phase, when we're starting to decelerate now under retro rocket.
Yeah, the parachute deploys, the rover's underneath it. It's coming down still at 200 miles an hour, and now you've got to cut the parachute loose, fire these rocket engines. Have you done this on Earth to see how it goes?
Well, we're unable to do an end-to-end system test on Earth because the environment on Earth is quite different from the environment on Mars. So what we do is we actually test the different elements of the system out. So we test the parachute system, we test how the things are actually cut away from each other, the separation mechanisms, and we test the engines. And then we actually couple all those things together in a simulation with all of our understanding of the performance of each one of those systems.
Is the separation maneuver to avoid the parachute, is it radical?
No, it's not radical. So anytime you have separable elements, you have to do this sort of diverting away from things, or you have to build in enough margin to the system so that you know the things won't come into contact with each other. So this is a way to ensure that there's no possible way that the parachute can come back and smack on top of the rover.
The powered descent, I guess it is made easier and safer by the fact that the gravity on Mars is not so strong.
That's correct. And we've got a total of 8 engines, and they're firing at around 3,600 newtons each. And they have a throttleable ability, which allows us to essentially fly this thing around. Of course, it's flying itself. Once again, it's autonomous. But it has that knowledge of its state and its position that it can do that.
And unlike the giant spaceship on Alien, which comes down onto the planet firing its rockets to keep it completely even, that's not going to happen. You're not taking this rover all the way to the ground with rockets.
No, we're not taking it all the way to the ground with rockets. So we have these 8 engines that are firing. And when we get about 21 meters above the surface, we actually start a maneuver called the sky crane maneuver. And that's basically where we lower the rover on a triple bridle, which basically looks like a tether, from the top of the spacecraft, which we call the descent stage. And we lower that tether, which is about 7 meters in length. And we basically descend all the way from the surface until the rover's wheels touch the ground. The rover's wheels are actually its landing gear. And so when it touches the ground, it touches the ground at a very, very slow speed, but less than 2 miles an hour.
But is it the rover that is hovering above? What do you call the craft?
Oh, the craft, which is basically hovering above, is called the descent stage. This descent stage actually has those 8 retro rockets on it.
And the descent stage is just staying completely stationary. How far above the planet?
Well, it's continuing to descend. So we actually
is.
Have this phase. We have a constant velocity phase, and then we have a constant acceleration phase. And so it's continuing to descend, continuing to descend. And when the rover's wheels touch the ground, it actually senses that. It cuts those tethers, which are connecting the rover to the descent stage, and it has enough propellant on board where it goes and flies away and does its own divert maneuver away from the rover to keep it at a safe distance before it lands.
How does it cut the wire?
Well, it's got a series. It has an electrical connection, which is called the umbilical cord, and it also has 3 connections of the tether. It actually physically cuts those with sort of like a little mini guillotine inside each one of them.
And then it turns and flies off and crashes?
Yes, and it has enough propellant on board that it can do that, and it crashes at a safe distance away, about 100 meters, a couple of hundred meters away from the rover.
This moment here where it's lowering the rover down on a wire, and again, seemed to me as I watched the video to be precarious.
Well, this maneuver actually is something which we use on the ground here on Earth with helicopters. So it's not entirely a new thing, for example. So you do have to understand what the interaction is between the aerodynamics of the descent stage above and then the aerodynamics of the rover hovering on this tether beneath. But we have very good data for what that looks like, and we have very good simulations which can actually take those things into account.
So
we have a good understanding of that.
I'd like to introduce another guest, also in Pasadena, is a Jet Propulsion Laboratory colleague, Ashwin Vasavada. Ashwin Vasavada, he's a deputy project scientist for the Mars Science Laboratory. While Anita is focused on the entry, descent, and landing of the rover, Ashwin's team is responsible for the science, the gathering and analyzing of rock samples, and all of the knowledge we hope to gain from the mission. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Wade.
Ashwin, once it's all down, then your job begins.
That's right. Everything that I've worked for the past, more than 8 years is on the other side of those 7 minutes of terror. So we're really rooting for for Anita and her team.
Let's talk a little bit about the 7 minutes of terror are obviously the most riveting moment of the early part of this mission, but the meat of this mission is what you're going to be doing, and what are you going to be doing?
Well, the purpose of the Mars Science Laboratory, and really the reason it's as big as it is to bring a laboratory to the surface of Mars. This mission has a pretty ambitious goal of taking us one step further on that quest to understand whether Mars ever had life or even has life today. And how we phrase that is we call it the search for habitable environments. We're going to go to a place on Mars that has a lot of evidence that it once was a wetter place, a place more suitable for life. And we're taking some very sophisticated geochemical laboratories with us to figure out if that really was the case. Were the conditions right at this site at some point in Mars history that Mars could have been a friendly place for life?
Tell me about the landing zone. Why did you pick it?
We picked this site after scouring the planet for a number of years using the orbiters that we have at Mars. And we were basically searching the planet for the most likely places to be suitable environments for life. And one of the things we realized, over the past few decades is when to look. So early in Mars history, its first few billion years, Mars was a very different place than it is today. It had a lot more water flowing on the surface. There's evidence for rivers and lakes and maybe even an ocean. So we're targeting a site that is an ancient site. What we're going to be looking at is the rocks preserved for us that date back to that time. So we're not searching for habitable environments in the present, but in the distant past. And that's why we need to take these laboratories and this incredible rover with its tools to sample those rocks and analyze them.
If you're worried that Americans don't care about the space program, there are many callers who would like to get on. Let's go to Dave. He's calling from Craftsbury, Vermont. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Hi. I just want to say that this talk of Mars, exploration and finding out whether there's been life there and putting labs on there and hopefully eventually people is really, really exciting to me. I mean, all the talk of global warming and all the research here and about the environmental consequences of our planet heating up, that's getting really boring and depressing. And this is really where the excitement is, is maybe getting 50 or 100 people to live on Mars. I mean, come on. This is really exciting.
Kelly, this is really exciting.
We don't really need to invest much more here on Earth.
You raise a good point, which is that space exploration, even 50 years plus into it, is still very exciting and very gripping. And I think there's a certain there's kind of a death watch here to see if the lander will crash or not. But our success rate has been pretty good. I'm personally excited by what the rover is going to do. There are more than 300 scientists associated with this mission, and there's a lot to do once this rover gets to Mars. It is an incredibly complicated, well-equipped spacecraft that can do a lot of things, and we expect a lot in return from it.
Ralph is calling from Orlando, Florida. Ralph, hello.
Hi, Wade. Yeah, I was. I recently discovered some three-dimensional pictures available on the internet of the previous Mars photographic explorations, and more specifically, anaglyph photographs that can be viewed on a conventional computer monitor with just the old-fashioned red-blue lenses. And I was hoping that there were going to be a lot of three-dimensional photographs as a result of this mission.
Ashwin, will there be?
Absolutely. That's not only important to share Mars with the public in that way, but the engineering team at JPL will use those three-dimensional images to actually navigate the rover across the surface. We depend on those in order to figure out how far that rock is away from us, if we want to drill into it, or to steer around a certain obstacle. So we'll be taking a lot of three-dimensional data. We, just like the previous rovers, we have two eyes to simulate how humans see in three dimensions.
Curiosity is the name of the rover. Is this the best exploring device ever created by man?
I'll say yes. We've worked hard to make it that way. I think everybody agrees it's the most complex vehicle NASA has ever landed on another planet, and we hope that really is the case after next Sunday night.
Is it really going to climb a 3-mile mountain?
We're going to study a 3-mile mountain. It turns out we only have to make it up the first few hundred meters of that mountain in order to accomplish our science. The record of this ancient environment on Mars that we're exploring is kind of in the bottom of the stack. Just like if you were going to go to the Grand Canyon, the oldest rocks are on the bottom and the youngest ones are on top. And so we need to get to the base of that mountain and make our way up it pretty substantially, but we won't be summiting.
It's 7 feet tall, 9 feet wide, 10 feet long, but I understand it's more nimble than the other rovers. How did you make it nimble when it's so much bigger? Did making it bigger actually make it easier to move around?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, we build these rovers based on the previous ones. So we have the same six wheels and the same suspension system that all the previous rovers have had, but it is quite a bit bigger. This rover is about 5 times as heavy as Spirit and Opportunity, the last two rovers. And yeah, you're right. Just in the sense that it's bigger, we have bigger wheels. We can, instead of steering around a certain rock, we can just drive right over it if we need to. But we will be, of course, extremely careful in how we use this. We're not going to go six-wheeling over Mars.
There's not going to be a big solar panel, I take it. I remember when the solar panels died, the sadness. This is going to be radioactive plutonium.
That's right. This is how we power spacecraft traditionally that go to the outer planets, for example, where the sun is quite dim. The Apollo missions use this power source on the moon. You basically bring some natural radioactive material with you that emits heat, and you turn that heat into a steady stream of electricity. And the rover is, in a sense, it's kind of like your cell phone. You have to charge it overnight and then use the battery up during the day. And that's exactly how we run the rover.
Tom is calling from Andover. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, Wade. Thank you for taking my call.
It's my pleasure.
You know, I recently read things about a radio telescope array. It's called the Square Kilometer Array in, I think it's South Africa. That's going to be looking for organic material in solar systems like millions of light years away from us. And I guess what my question is, you know, how come we're not getting more aggressive going to Mars, which is reachable to us? You know, and the rover is a step, but, you know, considering all the research that would be put into, you know, putting a man on Mars, putting people on Mars, and all of that research, what it would gain, you know, for industry and technology and knowledge on here and help our economy that we need it now, I guess, you know.
Sure, what, no, I understand. What, Kelly, why aren't we getting more aggressive?
Well, a couple of reasons. First, Wade, is that, and Tom, is that we can only go to Mars about every 2 years when Earth and Mars are lined up in the right place around the sun. So we can't just launch a spacecraft anytime we want. And in an ideal world, you'd be doing that every 2 years. But these missions are expensive. We mentioned earlier that it's about $2.5 billion. And just within NASA, whose annual budget is of order $20 billion, you have to make choices. Would you rather have a Mars mission or a Jupiter mission? Would you rather have planetary missions or the Hubble Space Telescope and its successor, the Webb Space Telescope? And these are the trade-offs that NASA has to do. Interestingly, in the budget that is being debated right now in Congress, President Obama made a cut to the planetary exploration budget in NASA of about 20%. It's not a done deal yet. Congress might restore it, but a lot of that cut came out of Mars exploration. If that goes through, we'll abandon a joint program with the Europeans that was to be launched in 2016. The next mission in 2018 is in jeopardy and so forth. So, I think a lot of us would like to be more aggressive with Mars and find out what really makes it tick. It's just one of in a number of priorities that has to be set.
Very briefly, what were those missions in 16 going to be?
They were going to be studying the atmosphere, and also the Europeans were going to set their first rover down on the surface. And I think it's an important point to mention that Curiosity will not be searching for life. It will be searching for organic material, perhaps, but not life itself.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about NASA's newest rover, 2 million miles out and closing, due to land in 10 days on the surface of Mars. My guests are Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky Telescope and Magazine, and Anita Sengupta, Senior Systems Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Deputy Project Scientist at JPL, and Ashwin Vasavada. He is the Deputy Project Scientist for the Mars Science Laboratory. Anita, I wanted to go back to you and go back to the moment when the rover is coming in for a landing, making this powered descent. At the moment that the heat shield breaks away, I understand that there's a camera that is going to begin to film the descent at that moment, which should be really quite amazing video.
Yeah, there's a camera called the MARTI instrument, which is going to be snapping 5 pictures every second. And we're going to be able to use those images to figure out what it looks like during the descent on Mars.
And tell us about the radar and how it is going to position the vehicle. What's going to happen at that moment when the heat shield breaks away?
So the radar has a total of 6 beams, and it's basically bouncing these beams, which are like radio waves, off of the surface. And what those beams allow it to do, it allows it to determine the velocity of the vehicle, both the vertical velocity, the up and down direction, and the horizontal velocity, the velocity side to side. It also allows us to determine what the distance is between the rover and the surface. And it uses that information with its onboard computer to figure out how to fly to where we want to actually land on the surface. It's a very sophisticated radar, and we have those different beams, and some of them are pointing straight down, some of them are pointing at a slight angle, and some of them are pointing at a larger angle or way.
And how soon will you be able to look at these photographs?
I think, Ashwin, you'd probably be able to answer that better about when the photographs actually come down.
Ashwin?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. We actually take a few days with this mission. It's such a complex vehicle, and of course, the landing event is so, you know, it can be a pretty traumatic experience for the rover. So we will actually spend a few days checking things out very carefully after we land. So we expect the images to trickle in. We won't have a whole lot the night of landing itself, maybe one or two images taken just out, peeking out the front and rear sides of the rover. But over the next few days, the next week after we land, we'll have a flood of beautiful color images, panoramas around the rover, and a complete movie of that descent, if all goes well, in kind of a thumbnail form. And then over the next few weeks of the mission, we'll get the larger kind of HD version of the movie down.
Anita, when the rover is hovering and lowering on a wire, how high up will it be off the planet?
So it starts the sky crane sequence where it starts to lower the rover on this tether at about 20 meters above the surface. So that's around 60 feet.
And is there any worry that even at that altitude that it could kick up dust that would land on the rover's cameras and make a mess?
So interestingly enough, one of the reasons why we use the sky crane maneuver is because if you took those engines all the way down to the surface, you would actually create a lot of dust that would go around the rover. So one of the main reasons why we use the sky crane maneuver is because increasing that distance between those retro rocket engines and the ground actually helps to mitigate the amount of dust which is produced.
Let's take a caller. Mark is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, my name's Mark Davis. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I have been making films about Mars rover missions out of Jet Propulsion Lab for the last 10 years or so. And I've made one about this current mission that'll be on the week after landing. And I wanted to throw into this conversation something that I've noticed over the years, which is that not just this mission, but every mission to Mars has been a hair-raising event for the people involved. And 7 minutes of terror is not a new term. Every landing has been a nail-biter. They're almost always trying to do something new. Every single one of them has hundreds of things that have to work perfectly for it to succeed. And the thing that impresses me about what I've seen is how well these people work under pressure and how thoroughly they understand the system, which is a brand-new system that's never been built before, how thoroughly they understand it before they let it go. So I would just like to say that they're not really rolling the dice. Yeah, there's risk. There's always risk, and perhaps a lot of risk. But it's not a wild guess. They've really put a lot into this.
Anita, Ashwin, do you feel like you're rolling the dice?
Not at all. Yeah, we've spent many, many years designing the system. We have excellent models of the performance of each one of the elements in our entry to South Atlantic system, for example. We have excellent models on the atmosphere of Mars. And so we have great understanding of what's going to happen. And we have great understanding, you know, down to the, you know, second level, all the events that are going to happen. So we do, I would definitely agree with the caller that we've spent many, many years understanding the system. And we know it to a high degree of fidelity of accuracy of what exactly is going to happen and how it's going to happen.
Ashwin, do you feel the same?
I do, but, you know, we're all human too, and this is Mars exploration, and it's still doing something that is very cutting edge, very much a challenge for, you know, humanity to go reach out and do something on another planet. So in spite of the fact that everything that the caller said is true, and I work with these guys down the hall, I have super confidence in their ability to have designed a system that will allow us to do our science on the surface. But I think we're all going to be biting our nails regardless.
Kelly?
Well, you know, one of the things that is new on this mission, in addition to this sky crane, is just the whole approach to the landing. The target zone is about 15 by 12 miles. It's not very big. It's a far smaller landing site area than has ever been possible before. And that's only possible because we're the spacecraft actively controls its descent, fires off those little thrusters. Gale Crater has been on the radar of geologists for a very long time. But if you had sent this mission to Mars even 5 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to land in it because the spot on the floor, it's only 100 miles across, the spot on the floor where it's flat and safe is too small to do except this way. And that's, I think, what makes it a really exciting mission.
Well, I think the fact that they plan to have grief counselors on hand when they're landing says something to the fact that this is not a done deal. Let's take another caller. Steve is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Steve, hello.
Hello, Wade. Thank you very much for taking my call. I had a question for Ms. Gupta. In modeling your landing procedure, and if I understand the term correctly, skyhook or sky landing, have you taken into account potential atmospheric conditions on the planet that might have winds in excess of the 2-mile-an-hour margin you've given yourself? And also, second part of my question was, how much of the technology was borrowed from the Viking missions, which landed on Mars in 1976, if memory serves? Thank you very much.
Anita?
Okay, those were great questions. So we do take into account the atmospheric variability on Mars. We actually include that in statistical simulations. So we understand what it can normally be, and then we include a large uncertainty band on top of that. So we take into account changes in temperature, changes in density, and changes in wind velocity in all the different directions. So that's definitely accounted for in our system. And then the second question was how much technology is taken from the Viking era. And actually, a lot of the technology is taken from the Viking era. So, for example, our parachute is a scaled-up version of the parachute that we flew on the Viking missions. Our general overall shape of our entry vehicle is quite similar, almost identical to the shape of the Viking vehicle, but it's much larger. And then another example would be our main landing engines, our retro rockets, are actually very similar to the Viking era design. So what we do that at NASA a lot is that when we have a technology that works for us, we oftentimes try to keep on using it, make slight upgrades to it, might increase the scale of it, but we can leverage off of our existing experience with that technology from all of our prior flights.
Ashwin, let's talk a little bit about the laboratory that's on board here. There is a hand lens imager on the end of a long arm. There's a mass spectrometer, a laser spectrometer, X-rays. Talk to me a little bit about what you can do.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful scientific payload, even harder to describe in just a few words. One thing we do when we start out is just survey the landscape. So we have some color HD cameras as well as a laser instrument that actually shoots a laser beam at rock and soil around the rover, creates a little spark. And by measuring the color of that spark, we can actually tell what the composition of the rocks and soils are around us. So we have these great survey tools to start out. Then we have the 7-foot robotic arm with a few instruments on the end of it. So if we find something interesting while we're surveying, we'll deploy that big arm and put a hand lens imager, which is basically a nod to geologists on Earth who always have a hand lens in their pocket to look up up close at rocks and soils. So we can do that, as well as take some chemistry measurements with that arm. And then the real, you know, new capability that this rover brings that's never been done before by a rover is to drill into rocks, gather powder from the inside of those rocks, which is where we think all that evidence of habitability, resides, and then deliver that powder to these laboratories on the rover. We have a mass spectrometer and a gas chromatograph. These are basic scientific tools that are in every university laboratory, but we've miniaturized them and brought them to Mars with us, as well as an instrument called an X-ray diffractometer, which really, you shine an X-ray through rock particles, which are little crystals, and you create a kind of a rainbow pattern, and that pattern is distinctive for every mineral in those samples. So we have really the state-of-the-art, best instruments to do mineralogy and chemistry on Mars. And as Kelly mentioned, looking for these organic materials as well as all that other evidence for habitable environments.
Tom is calling from Grand Junction, Colorado. Tom, hello.
Hi, Wade. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
This is fun for me because I'm actually on my way to visit a friend who had two trips to the Hubble telescope to repair it and a couple other missions to space. So it's kind of a fun conversation. Quick question. If there is at any point in these studies evidence of life or actually find life, does NASA have a contingency plan for how they would announce that and who would win the Nobel Prize? And have they thought through the kind of the social implications of an announcement of life on another planet or evidence of life?
Kelly, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, again, I want to emphasize that Curiosity is not going to be searching for life. If I could paint an analogy here, it's kind of like Curiosity is going to be a little like a field geologist with a really good camera and who has the ability to eat rocks and tell you what the rocks are made of. But it won't be able to tell life. The organic material that it might find, and that's a might, would tell you that at some point in the past there was organic material there. That in and of itself is not evidence for life. Really, the only lander in the history of space exploration that truly tried to detect life were the Vikings back in 1976. And so we are kind of getting back to the future in a way with that stepwise. And I think the announcement that there were organics on the surface of the planet would be a straightforward one. And I actually would be really surprised if there were. Part of the issue here is that Mars has a very harsh environment, not just the temperature, which is quite cold, but its surface, because its atmosphere is so thin, it has no magnetic field to speak of. The surface is bombarded by radiation all the time. And this makes it very difficult to keep organic material around, even if it were there. It would be broken down, and there is likely no trace of it. So unless Curiosity, toward the end of its mission, were, you know, pushed up against a boulder and sent it tumbling down the slope so they could see what was underneath, I think maybe Ashwin can address this. What are the prospects of actually finding organic matter there?
Ashwin?
Well, thank you. That's one of the big questions, of course, for the mission. And, you know, and it really, it could go in different directions. We actually don't understand Mars' environment enough to make a good prediction. We do know that there are organic materials delivered to Mars by meteorites all the time. Mars should have some inherent reservoir of carbon, just like our rocks do on Earth. What we don't know is how much it is destroyed, as Kelly was saying. We do feel that it should be destroyed by the ultraviolet light and the radiation that comes in from space. One of the reasons we think it's so important to drill into rocks is to get at least a few centimeters below the surface of a rock to where you're less affected by what's going on the surface, especially other chemicals that could destroy evidence of these organics. So, yeah, we'll be looking hard in a lot of different ways for this organic material.
Bob is calling from Boston. Bob, hello.
Good day. So I'll make my comments very brief. A long-term study of astrophysics in the Boston area, the question is around generational terraforming. And so what is the time frame? Now we're looking at instrumentation. We're doing soil analysis, organic studies, materials from planetary material. What is the time frame for terrestrial formation?
I'm not sure who to throw that to. Ashwin, do you have an idea?
Well, yeah, it's sort of one of those questions in the realm of between science fiction and science, what research is actually being carried out. If I understand the question right, is how long it would take to transform.
Well, Kelly is nodding and saying that he's going to take a shot at this. Kelly,
yeah,
why don't
yeah,
you try?
Let me jump in, Bob, if I understand your question. In terms of how long it took the Earth to form, way back 4.5 billion years ago, we're talking about a relatively brief period of time, but it was still tens of millions of years. And then, you know, the Earth long ago was nothing like the Earth today. There was no oxygen atmosphere. It was a very harsh, inhospitable place. And over time, our climate and just the whole nature of the chemistry on the surface has changed a lot. And if I can throw this, sort of reflect this back onto Mars, this is one of the key issues that we want to understand with Curiosity. What was Mars like early in its history? Was it more Earth-like than it is now?
Ashwin, a quick question from a radio man. Will there be a microphone on board?
No, unfortunately, there's no microphone. Lots of 17 cameras, but no microphone. We're sorry.
It's quite all right.
Next time.
I want to thank my guests this hour. In Pasadena, California, Anita Sengupta, Senior Systems Engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Ashwin Vasavada, Deputy Project Scientist for the Mars Science Laboratory. Thank you both. And here in Boston, Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine. Big thanks to you, too.
My pleasure. And I'll be in that auditorium watching it come down, too.
Thanks, everyone. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You'll also see the 7 Minutes of Terror and other great videos and links. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.